So, my talk actually has two titles. So it was advertised as The Wisdom of Water. That's its poetic title. But it's actually about, as well, directions towards the gateways of liberation. So I've linked two things. And the birth of this talk really happened in Ireland this year. I went to visit Geraldine, who used to be at the London Buddhist Centre, and she moved back to where the area where she was born, which is a beautiful, stunning, actually, area of west, on the west coast of Ireland, the Dingle Peninsula. So I had the good fortune to go there. And I had some quite strong experiences of water. Maybe the water element and the earth element. And my favourite sort of landscape is mountains next to the sea. So my talk is going to include the Brandon Mountains on the west coast of Ireland and the Atlantic Ocean. But before I sort of enter into that watery landscape, I want to say just something about the three gateways of liberation that I'm going to be sort of trying to communicate something about, just so you know what they are. And it seemed appropriate to sort of link my water inspiration with these three gateways, because they come about through deep contemplation of the three Lakshanas. And that's what we've been looking at the women's class over the last few weeks. These are the marks of conditioned existence. So that if you contemplate them deeply, you can enter the gateways of liberation. So just to say what they are. So they're known as vimokshas. So they're gateways of liberation or gateways of freedom, vimokshas. And these three vimokshas, they have a quality of freedom that is just slightly different. But if you, whichever gateway you go through, you arrive at the same place, which is basically enlightenment. And obviously, I'm just talking theory here. I don't have direct experience of them. But what I do have is inspiration and faith that there is a path towards them. So these vimokshas, each one is a samadhi. And you may have come across the word samadhi. It's sometimes known as meditative concentration, but that sort of in its, like with a small s, but with a big s, it is enlightened awareness. So it's like illuminated awareness or non-dual awareness. So these samadhis, I'll just tell you what they are now. So when we deeply contemplate impermanence, that leads to the gateway of the signless samadhi. When you deeply contemplate unsatisfactoriness, that leads to the unbiased samadhi. And when you contemplate insubstantiality, that leads to shunyata, or voidness, or the deathless samadhi. So, that's a sort of theoretical background to where we're, what I'm going to try and communicate something of. So, back to Ireland. So, we're in the Brandon Mountains, and Geraldine and I drove up a lane to find a footpath that would take us higher up into the mountains. And from the other side of the valley, we'd seen what to me was a glacial lake. And I really wanted to go up the mountain and find this lake that we had seen. There wasn't an official footpath, so we just sort of had to head through a farm and then follow upwards to where we thought the lake was. And we soon came across a small lake, but Geraldine said that that's not the lake we could see from the road. I wasn't quite convinced, but anyway, to me it felt like, oh, we'd found a secret lake. And I was really fascinated by the landscape. My favourite subject when I was at school was physical geography and geology. So I'm going to take just some time giving some preparatory directions to the gateway of the signless samadhi. And I'm going to do this with reference to three levels of wisdom. As Vanaraji said, we're in the wisdom zone this session. So we're going to look at the three levels of wisdom. Because we need all three of them if we're going to approach the gateways. So I'm going to start with the first level of wisdom. And this level is learning and listening, just like hearing the Dharma, so like you're hearing it now. But there's many things that we can learn about. So I'm just going to tell you a little bit about physical geography so that you know what I'm on about in terms of the points I want to make in the talk. So we're in these mountains, and they are in the Ice Age. Basically, you had loads of snow on the top of the mountains, and it would compact down to make ice. And when that ice would sort of move down the mountain, it was quite abrasive, and it would actually carve particular shapes out of the landscape. And one of these shapes is that it all piles up sort of in a particular area, and it carves out a hole. So it all comes down the mountain and then it carves out a hole, which then later forms a lake. And then before it goes on down the mountain in the form of a glacier. So that's where you get the lake from. Because this hole has been carved out. So I was really in my element as we were by this lake, which I knew was a glacial lake, and we walked up to the end of the lake, and we found ourselves surrounded by like three sides of really sheer mountains. So that's like the ice has just cut them really steeply. And I felt as if I could feel the magnetic current, because you've got mountains on three sides and they're really high, sort of you're in the middle as if it's going through your body. And I felt like as if we were in the belly of a mountain, as if we were inside a mountain. And every aspect of the landscape seemed to then have meaning to me. I understood the landscape, you know, through knowing the physical geography, but it was more than that. The landscape started to come alive as if everything had meaning. So this moves on to the second level of wisdom, which is reflecting and thinking. So when you hear the Dharma, it's like, that's one level, but it's until you actually reflect on it and think, well, how can this affect my life? What meaning has this got for me? That you take it to the next level and it affects your life. So this is the second level of wisdom. So basically, when I returned from this walk, I thought, oh, I've definitely had some experiences up in that mountain. And I jotted down a few little notes. And they were all about water, just different aspects of water. And then later on, some months later, actually, when I was thinking, when I thought, oh, I'm going to try and give a talk about this, I reflected on these aspects more deeply. So they took me to other places, and actually Vanaraji sort of mentioned about my interest in the arts. So you're going to get a bit of now my inspiration through the arts in terms of my reflections. So basically, looking at these steep rock faces, they were completely, they were like wet with water. So there was just water rushing down on all sides. And in certain places, the little piles of sediment would sort of gather, maybe in a crag in the rocks. And a little bit of life, something would spring to life. The combination of the sediment and the light, but the water, without the water, the life wouldn't be there. And traditionally, water is a symbol of life. So I was looking at a painting by an artist, an Italian Renaissance artist called Titian. And in this painting, it shows the moment when the goddess Diana discovers that one of her nymphs has become, they're supposed to be virgin nymphs, has become pregnant. So it's a sort of dramatic moment that Titian has painted. And in this painting, there's a sort of urn with water flowing out of it, and it creates a stream. And so in the painting, it's a symbol of life. I love just seeing symbolism come alive in paintings. So you've got this poor stricken nymph, but the whole symbolism is just is saying life through water. And actually all the other nymphs in the painting, all their names are they're like water names because of the potentiality of life. But as I say, they're supposed to be virgin nymphs. So to me the mountains were totally alive with water. The other thing that fascinates me is that our bodies are made up of about 60% water. It's hard to imagine. And each of us, I think the average female, has about 30 to 35 litres of fluid within us. So we are water. We are a large percentage of us is water. And my point really is that the whole of us is involved in the spiritual life, in our life, our whole body. It's not just, you know, we might think, oh, we're more of a head or we're more of our hands because our hands can do things. But actually, it's our whole body. And a question that just rose for me was, you know, what do we want to do with our precious human life? What do we want to do? If we know that our life is impermanent, we've been given this gift of life, what do we want to do with it? So our whole body, our whole being, we've got a choice. So I'm going somewhere else now to another exhibition, another image, which is a sculpture this time of a dancing satyr. And it's, well, I thought it was an amazing sculpture that is from, it's a 4th century BC Greek sculpture. And it was only discovered about 20 or 30 years ago under the sea. And what I find amazing about it is that it's actually lost both arms and one leg, but it's sculpted in the round. So this means you can see it from all sides. You can just walk around it and it's dancing. Whichever angle you look at it, it's got movement. So this satyr is dancing. And what is left of the body, it really expresses that movement. So again, it's like her whole body thing, movement. The thing with satires is that actually they might be beautiful and they can dance, but they're not always very well behaved. I seem to be into nymphs and satires. But basically, satires are known to seduce sleeping nymphs. So they're not well behaved, basically. So my point here is that we want all our energies to be available for the spiritual life. We don't want to hold back, but we need to channel that energy skillfully, right? We need to be conscious of what we're doing and make choices, skillful choices. So water is also associated with purification. So we've had water associated with life, with energy, with flow, but it's also associated with purification. And the spiritual life involves really a continuous process of purification. And the samadhis are going to be very distant to us if we are not acting skillfully with body, speech and mind. So our first task that we often find out when we sit down to meditate is that we need to have a clear conscience to go deeper in our meditation. We want to act skillfully. So as water pours and drips off the mountain, it collects into little channels. If we repeat unskillful habits, basically those unskillful channels are going to, the grooves are going to get deeper, and it's going to be more difficult to change those habits. Similarly, if we act skillfully, the skillful channels will get stronger. So basically what I felt when I was up in the mountain was I found a clear streamlet of water, and it was a beautiful streamlet, and that it ran towards this lake. So it basically, all this water comes off these steep mountains, and then it made one little streamlet, and then it went into the lake. So yeah, we want a purified streamlet. So now I'm going to move on to the third level of wisdom, and this is the meditative level of wisdom. So this is not where you're thinking about your experience, but you're actually being your experience. You're in it. You're in your experience and you're aware of it. So that's like meditation. You're actually in your experience and aware. So for me, I was up at the streamlet and it just felt like playtime, really. I felt as if I took my place in the vast mountainous landscape as a small being who was influenced by her surroundings. So I could move about and enjoy the sensuousness of the elements. I was jumping across the streamlet from one soft grassy bank to another. I was pretending that I was crossing to the further shore. And there were like boulders to climb on and different shapes, different textures. And then just gazing into this streamlet of clear water, really fresh, and putting my hand in, and it was cool, fresh, clear, and it was like a direct experience of touch, of temperature, of sight, and of sound of the stream passing through my hand. So it's the quality of clarity that is going to lead us to the signless doorway to liberation. But it's not clarity of understanding, although that it supports the sort of clarity we need here. It's clarity about the true nature of one's experience as you're having it, because you're in your experience. And clear flowing water is a symbol of that for me, because it's like if you watch water flowing, every millisecond of water, it's just constantly changing. You can't say, you can't sort of stop a river. It's just flowing, and it's impermanent, basically. So there's nothing, you can't fix it. So water for me is, it's communicating that experience of just constant impermanence. And when you really know that impermanence at your depths, you're contemplating the lakshana, the mark of conditioned existence of impermanence. So water is a symbol of that. But water is like a name that we actually give to the experience of fluidity. We give it a name. But actually fluidity, the actual experience of water, is the texture, the touch, the sound, the sight of it. So each moment of a conditioned arising and passing away that we experience, it's like you don't need a name or a concept. It's an experience. So this is why the samadhi is called the signless samadhi, because it's when you're actually in the experience without names, without signs, without concepts. So there's no conceptualization of our experience. So that's the first door of liberation. So we might experience this, you may well have experienced it for moments in nature, you're just in it as I was then. It might be in meditation you experience that. You're not having to give names to everything and have stories about it and concepts. You're just experiencing it with clarity. Yes, I did have an experience of water up in the mountains. But of course, and you've probably recognized this yourself, but you have an experience and you want to take something home. You know, immediately, there's something in my mind that wants to fix it. Which is sort of natural, but it's not just staying with the experience. So I have to say that after a while, I started collecting some stones that I could see through the clear water, so I just brought a few of them, which are on the shrine there. It's like that compulsion to try to sort of want things to be permanent. You know, that you have a good experience and you want them to be permanent. But there was some impermanence of experience as well. Something I found interesting is that the very first Buddhist nuns who became enlightened disciples of the Buddha, they often gained enlightenment through experiences within the natural environment, through observing just natural change. So I'm just going to tell you about one of these nuns, these enlightened disciples of the Buddha. And her name is Bada. And basically she was a solitary wanderer at the time of the Buddha. And she would go around and listen to teachings from different... there were lots of different spiritual teachers at that time. So she'd go around listening, learning from those spiritual teachers, learning their practices, learning their philosophies. And she was particularly good at debating because she had so much knowledge. So one day she met Sariputra, who is a disciple of the Buddha, and they got into a debate, and Sariputra beat her, and she was obviously hardly ever beaten in these debates, but with Sariputra he beat her. So she said, well, I'd like to be your disciple, I'd like to go for refuge to you, I'd like to follow you. But Sariputra said, no, don't follow me, follow my teacher, and my teacher is the Buddha. So she went off to listen to the Buddha teaching. And that day, or whenever it was, the Buddha was teaching on impermanence. And this is what, basically, the early nuns, what they've left us is songs of their experiences. So I'm just going to read a little bit of the beginning of her song. Having heard the Dharma from him, I purified the vision of the Dharma. When I'd understood the true Dharma, I asked for the going forth and ordination. So she was ordained, and very soon after her ordination, she gained enlightenment. And she gained enlightenment while watching a bowl of thrown out water just run down the hill and sink into the earth. So that was how she gained enlightenment, through watching that natural process. So her song continues. Then, having been fully ordained, I observed a little streamlet of water. Through that stream of foot-washing water, I knew the process of rise and fall. Then I reflected that all formations are exactly the same in nature. Right on the spot, my mind was released, totally freed by the end of clinging. The victor then appointed me the chief of those with quick understanding. So she was obviously unusual in that she gained enlightenment so quickly. And maybe it was through the signless, maybe she went through the gate of the signless samadhi, who knows. Anyway, moving on. Geraldine and I, we left the secret mountain, the secret mountain lake, and we went looking for the other lake that we thought we had seen from the road. And I remember that my mood slightly changed, because it was quite a hard sort of slog up a hill over very rough country, and we didn't really know where this lake was. We couldn't see it. Lots of boulders, and it was a bit unsteady under your feet. You didn't know where you're putting your feet. But I suppose I, anyway, was hoping, you know, we'd find another lake, maybe the same or even better, because it was just so amazing, the first one. So this brings me to the second samadhi. First of all, the second mark of conditioned existence, which is suffering or unsatisfactoriness. So if we contemplate this deeply, the unsatisfactoriness of conditioned existence, this is the next contemplation. So the thing with the unenlightened mind is that we may well experience pure pleasure, but we always react at some point. So if we've had a pleasurable experience, as we had had, and we're holding on to it, it'll be suffering if we're holding to it. And it's suffering when a pleasure ends. And it's suffering to be in a state of wanting more of a pleasure that has passed. And pain, obviously, is suffering, just direct pain. And unpleasant experience is suffering, if we push it away. So that's going to give us an extra suffering, if we're pushing away unpleasant things. So I think as we were going up that hill, I was sort of experiencing a bit of a combination of those. And when we found the second lake, my experience was disappointment. It was a much larger lake, and it didn't have these steep mountains on all sides, and it was quite exposed, and I was probably a bit tired, and the wind was blowing in our faces. So disappointment is an interesting emotion. It's like wanting things to be other than they actually are. So comparing with a previous experience, rather than being able to just experience the new experience afresh. So on the surface of this lake, it was all choppy. And another association with the water element is that it's associated with emotions. And little wavelets on the top of a lake, they're like oscillating. So they're a sort of symbol of how we can just oscillate or react. We go from a pleasurable experience, and then you go to an unpleasurable experience, and then you just swing back and forth. So it's a symbol of that as well. So what we need here is sensitivity. Sensitive to our direct experience through the senses, and to be responsive to changes, because things are just changing all around us all the time, and sometimes it's pleasant and sometimes it's unpleasant. But if we can be sensitive to those changes, we don't need to react and sort of want to cling on to the pleasant ones and push away the unpleasant ones. And that sensitivity, it's full of metta. It's responsive and it's metaphor if there's unpleasant experience. So, this responsiveness can lead to the next samadhi, which is called the biasless samadhi. It's also known as the aimless samadhi or the wishless samadhi. It's like a samadhi where you have no particular aim. Basically, you've got no wish to be anywhere other than you are in the present. You just would want to be more deeply in the present. So you're not wishing to be elsewhere. So it's got a still quality, and you don't want to move in any particular direction. So it's like a mental state that it doesn't sort of incline in one direction towards likes or dislikes. You're just experiencing life. So it's known as the biasless samadhi, and it's poised. It's a state of sort of poise. So in a way we can see my state at that point was not particularly poised. So I remember then returning back, like going downhill, and that was more pleasurable, and then sitting in the protection of the car, it's like that was more pleasurable. So it's just like that sort of swinging from one thing to the other. But in meditation, when one's sitting still, I think it's a bit easier to practice this sensitivity to experience. So just allowing the pleasant and unpleasant sensations, emotions, thoughts, and images to arise and pass away. And I find it like a really good experience when you realize that you haven't grasped on to a pleasant experience, or you haven't pushed away an unpleasant one. You've just allowed yourself to sit in meditation and experience pleasant and unpleasant rising and passing away. And I think that just seeing deeply that there is suffering in one's own experience. There is pleasant experience, but there's also unpleasant. And it sort of just connects you with the universality of suffering, of unsatisfactoriness, that everybody is experiencing this. And I suppose the more we can experience this in meditation, then the more, when we're out of meditation, and our life's moving quite fast, maybe, we can find that we're not reacting so much, that we're actually able to be responsive and sensitive to our experience. So, moving on. From here we drove down to the coast. So all the streams are running down the valley side to form a river. And the speed of the flowing water carries the sediment that's been eroded from the mountains. So seeing this symbolically, I sort of see all the baggage that we all carry with us, that we pick up through our life and maybe through previous lives. So our minds can be clouded by sediment, and we carry the sediment along because of clinging. Because of self-clinging, we attach to things and we just carry them along with us. How often do we just allow ourselves to have a pure experience without attaching to it, without appropriating it, or making a story about it? We're constantly sort of building ourselves up, so saying, this is me, this is mine. And if I'm saying, this is me, this is mine, then that means that is you and that is yours. So there's a separation there. So self-clinging leads to separation. That state of separation and having a sort of fixed self isn't how things really are. Conditioned existence is actually, it's insubstantial, and it isn't about having a fixed self and being separate. So I'm now going to talk about a teaching that is known, of the Buddha, that is known as the simile of the ocean. So in this teaching of the simile of the ocean, the chief of the asuras are sort of like demigods. He approaches the Buddha and the Buddha asks him a question. He asks the asura, what are the qualities of a great ocean? And the asura describes eight qualities of the great ocean. So I'm just going to say something about two of those qualities. So the fourth simile that he gives, the asura says, when the mighty rivers, which each have a name, when they reach the great ocean, they lose their former names and designations, and they are reckoned just as the great ocean. So the Buddha says, even so, when members of the four castes go forth from home into the homeless life and follow the teachings of the Buddha, they lose their former names and lineage and are reckoned as sons and daughters of the Buddha. So this is a direction towards the next samadhi, the voidless samadhi. There are so many things that we identify with. So in that example, he's talking about the caste system in India because people are very attached to their caste. But there are so many things we identify with and we think, this is me, this is mine, it is fixed. Our gender, our bodily attributes, our race, our ethnicity, our class, our family, our friends, our activities, our work. It's like all these things we build ourselves up, like this is me. And it is very, very important to really understand how all these different things condition us and make us who we are today. But there's also a process of just letting go of all these things that give us our identity and that we cling to. Because if we're clinging to them in any way, it's like a false security. Because we're just saying, this is me, and it gives a separation from other. So there's a separation between self and other. So this is a big process of letting go. If we're really going to flow into the ocean. So it's a lifetime's work, more than a lifetime's work probably, to really understand all our conditioning and then be able to let go. So the river slows as it enters the ocean and it drops all the sediment. It drops clinging to self as we resolve all our conditioning and enter the openness and spaciousness of the vast ocean. So it's the qualities of openness and spaciousness that we need if we're going to enter the ocean. Dropping things, letting go, goes hand in hand with openness. So if you let go, you automatically become more open. If you're more open, you let go. So it's a liberation. So as we enter the great ocean, we enter the gateway of the deathless samadhi, voidness or shunyata. So the beauty of this bit of the Irish coastline really affected my mind. You had the Brandon Mountains behind you. If you're standing on the beach, there was just like a vast, vast white sandy beach with crashing waves, a white line of crashing waves, and then the Atlantic Ocean just, spreading out to the horizon. So being in that sort of stunning landscape, well, it affects the mind. And that sort of vista would appear in my meditation, like a bit more hazy and a bit more mysterious, as if it had no beginning and no end. And I remember one day I wanted that sort of expansive feeling was happening in meditation, and it was as if I wanted a Buddha to appear. I thought, wouldn't it be great to just have a Buddha in the middle of that vast sort of expanse. But no Buddha would appear. So in a way, Buddhas, they just appear and disappear in open space. So there isn't really a distinction between form, like the shape of a Buddha, and just emptiness and vastness. In the Heart Sutra, we say form is only emptiness, emptiness only form. The ocean is a symbol of that emptiness, shunyata. It's a symbol of the deathless samadhi. So in a way, emptiness is the Buddha, and the Buddha is the ocean. So they're all the same. They're all the same thing. So I come to the sixth simile from that sutta, in which the Asura says. So the Buddha's asked him about the great ocean, and he says, The ocean has one taste, the taste of salt. And the Buddha says, just as the ocean has but one taste, the taste of salt, the Dharma has one taste, the taste of freedom. So I'm just going to finish with just a few lines from a sutra called the Vimalakirti Nidesha Sutta. What is joy in the pleasures of the Dharma? It's the joy of unbreakable faith in the Buddha. It's the joy of the renunciation of the whole world and not being fixed in objects. It's the joy of always guarding the spirit of enlightenment, of helping other beings. It's the joy of the exploration of the three doors to liberation.